Chapter 26. Juan stood on the bridge wing and watched the old school buses crawl across the causeway that led to Cabinda's only pier, each painted in garish colors and belching oily exhaust as their old engines labored. They threaded their way around a string of shipping containers and some donated farm equipment that had just been unloaded from a Russian freighter berthed ahead of the Oregon. Because his ship was pumped dry of ballast in order to reach the relatively shallow anchorage, he had a good view of the city and the hills beyond. With dawn just breaking, he noted that little of Angola's oil wealth had been spent in the city nearest the fields. Down on the quay, Max Hanley and Franklin Lincoln waited with a customs official. Both were dressed like a couple of wharf rats in keeping with the Oregon's decrepit appearance. Tiny Gunderson's bush pilot friend was with them, too, to make sure everything went smoothly, as well as Mafana, Ndebele's old sergeant. The customs man had already given a briefcase to his wife, who'd come down to the docks for the specific reason of taking the bribe money back home with her. The elevator from the op center suddenly rose up from the bridge floor. Linda Ross didn't wait until it had come even with the deck before jumping off and rushing toward Cabrillo.
"Juan, you don't have your phone on," she said hotly. "The attack's started. Holly's intercepting calls from the Petromax facility to their headquarters in Delaware. They estimate at least 400 armed men have stormed the gates, and the platforms are reporting a large number of small boats are heading their way. Security is being completely overrun." He had hoped and prayed that they'd have a day at least to work with Moses and Ndebele's troops, but somehow he'd known he wasn't going to get it. He would have to trust that time hadn't dulled the skills they'd honed in their bitter civil war nearly 3 decades ago. Cabrillo cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted Max's name. When Hanley glanced up, Juan made a motion with his arm to hurry things along. Max said something to Mafana just as the first of the buses screeched to a halt at the foot of the gangplank. The side door opened and a string of men emerged. The first went to give Mafana a congratulatory hug for rescuing Moses and Ndebele, but the African rebel must have told him to get aboard quickly. The men started up to the main deck as the other buses pulled alongside the ship. Juan activated his phone and dialed down to the hangar where he knew George Gomez Adams would be with his chopper. The pilot answered on the second ring.
"Fly-by-night Airlines."
"George, Juan."
"What's up, Chairman?"
"Singer's men have launched their attack. As soon as we clear the harbor, I want to send up one of our UAVs."
The unmanned aerial vehicles were essentially commercial model airplanes outfitted with miniature cameras and infrared detectors.
"I'll get it prepped," Adams said, "but I can't fly both if you need the chopper."
"Tiny's coming aboard with Ndebele's men. He'll fly it. I just want you to get it ready."
"I'm on it."
Cabrillo glanced over the rail again. Two lines of men were marching up the gangway. None of them were overweight, which didn't surprise him since they lived in a refugee camp, but there were a few giants among them. He saw more gray hair than he had hoped, but the former freedom fighters looked capable. These weren't bowed old men, but lean, hungry soldiers who knew their duty. He called Eddie Seng to tell him to meet the new arrivals, but his shore operations director was already at the head of the gangway directing the soldiers to one of the ship's holds, where Moses and Ndebele was waiting to address them. It was there that they would be outfitted with assault rifles, ammunition, and other gear. Pressed by the urgency of the attack being underway, Juan's people seemed to have found new heights of efficiency. He expected no less. Eric Stone had been watching the procession over the closed-circuit television system from the op center. As soon as Max and Link followed the last soldier up the gangplank, it immediately began to rise. Juan looked up to see a dense cloud of smoke boil from the Oregon's funnel.
The busted-looking intercom mounted just inside the bridge wing door chimed.
"We're ready," Eric said when Juan answered. He looked down the length of the ship where a stevedore was waiting by the aft line.
He threw the man a signal and he heaved the heavy rope off the bollard and let it slide into the water.
A capstan immediately started reeling it into the ship.
Juan repeated the motion to the longshoreman waiting near the bows. Before he could tell Stone that they were free, he saw water boil between the Oregon and the dock as the athwartship thrusters came online. When they cleared the stern of the Russian freighter, Eric powered up the magnetohydrodynamics, keeping the speed down so her forward momentum wouldn't cause the hull to squat or settle deeper in the water. It was only when they were a mile from the shallow harbor that he started pouring on the power.
Juan waited on the flying bridge for another couple of moments, knowing it would be his last seconds of peace until the mission was over. The slide of dread he'd felt when Linda told him the attack had begun was giving way to a new sensation, one he knew too well. It was the first feeling of adrenaline being pumped into his body. It was almost as though he could detect each time his adrenal glands secreted a dose into his bloodstream. His stump was still sore, but he no longer felt it. His back still ached, but it no longer bothered him. He no longer missed the sleep he hadn't gotten. His mind became focused on the task at hand, and his body responded, willing to do whatever he asked of it. He turned to Linda.
"Ready?"
"Aye." On the elevator down to the op center, he asked her about Susan Dunleavy.
"I had planned on talking to her today, but, well..."
"No problem," Juan said. The elevator doors whisked open.
"Holly, what's the latest?"
"Petromax is trying to reach the provisional authorities to tell them about the attack, but so far the government hasn't responded. Nothing's happening in the workers' compound. The assault is focused solely on the terminal and the offshore rigs. It seems two platforms are under terrorist control, while two more are trying to defend themselves using firefighting water cannons. One of the rig's tool pushers radioed that he's lost a couple of men to small arms fire and that he doesn't think they can hold out much longer."
"Eric, what's our ETA?"
"An hour."
"Murph, weapons status?"
Mark Murphy craned around to look at Juan.
"We're loaded for bear, Chairman."
"Okay, good. Oh, and guys, nice job finding the radio-tagged guns. God knows how much worse things would get if we'd been floundering around the Congo River."
Cabrillo turned to head for his cabin and noted Chuck Tiny Gunderson seated at a workstation at the back of the room. In front of him was a computer monitor. On screen was an image of George Adams cleaning the lens of the camera mounted in the nose of the aerial drone.
"Looks good," Tiny said into his mic. He moved his hands over the computer keyboard.
"Step back. I'm firing the engine now."
The camera began to vibrate as the plane's little motor caught.
"Okay, green across the board. Up, up and away."
The image began to move as the plane sped down a launch ramp, past the Oregon's forward derricks, and then over the railing. Tiny brought its nose down with a joystick, exchanging altitude for speed, and then eased back on the stick to send it into the sky. Juan went to his cabin to get ready. Before changing into his newly refurbished combat leg and dark fatigues, he turned on his computer to get the live feed from the UAV's cameras. He kept one eye on the monitor as he readied his arsenal of weapons. The 4-foot-long airplane was at about 1,000 feet and flying over the large peninsula that the Oregon had to go around in order to reach the Petromax oil terminal. A more powerful transmitter aboard had allowed them to expand the drone's range from 15 miles up to 40, so it no longer had to stay so close to the ship.
It flashed over farmland and jungle, and finally the area of mangrove swamps that effectively cut off the port from the rest of Cabinda, save for a single road. Tiny dropped the plane down so it was 500 feet off the haul road. A few miles from the entrance to the terminal, a line of trucks sat idle. Juan guessed why, and in a moment the camera revealed the road had been blocked by felled trees. Because the ground just off the road was so soft, the big tanker trucks couldn't turn around. It would take giant earth movers or a week of chainsawing to remove the obstacle. If the Angolan government did send troops, they would have to abandon any fighting vehicles well short of their target. Having studied satellite pictures of the remote port, Cabrillo had anticipated this move because it was exactly what he would have done had he been in charge of the assault. He watched as Tiny made the model plane gain altitude again as it neared the terminal. From 1,000 feet, everything looked normal at first. The 200-acre facility sprawled along the coast, with a massive tank farm at its southernmost point and a separate compound for workers' dormitories and recreational facilities to the north. Between them were miles of pipes in 100 different sizes, twisting and bending together in a maze only its designers could understand. There were warehouses as large as anything Cabrillo had ever seen, as well as a harbor for the tenders and workboats that took personnel to and from the offshore rigs. Shooting off from the facility was a mile-long causeway that led to the loading berths for the supertankers that took the crude to markets all over the globe. 1,000-foot tanker was tied to one, her tanks empty if Juan were to judge by the amount of red anti-fouling paint he could see above her waterline. He spotted a large building constructed on a specially hardened pad near one of the terminal's tallest vent towers. Juan knew from the research his people had done there were 3 General Electric jet engines inside the structure that provided electricity to the whole installation. High-tension power lines ran from it to every corner of the port. 3 miles off the coast sat a string of dozens of oil rigs running northward like a man-made archipelago, each connected back to the port by undersea pipelines. Though not as large as rigs Juan had seen in the North Sea or the Gulf of Mexico, each was at least 200 feet tall, their superstructures held above the waves on massive support piers. It all appeared normal, except when he started looking more carefully. Some of the flames he saw weren't from natural gas being intentionally burned off. Several trucks had been set ablaze, and more than one building was wreathed in sooty smoke. The tiny stick figures lying randomly around the yard were the corpses of workers and members of the security force who'd been gunned down by Macambo's soldiers. What Juan first took to be shadows around them were actually pools of blood. Tiny Gunderson then swept the drone over the shoreline and out along the causeway. The pipes that fed the floating dock looked as big around as rail cars. Juan cursed when he saw the men swarming around the loading gantries. They had removed them from the tanker, and now crude oil was being dumped into the sea in 4 thick streams. The spill already surrounded the pier and was spreading by the second. One of the men must have seen the drone because suddenly several of them looked up. Some pointed with their arms, while others opened fire at the little plane. The chance of hitting the UAV was remote, but Tiny juked the aircraft and headed for the nearest offshore platform. From a half mile away, Juan could see it was ringed with oil. The crude weighed enough to crush the waves that tried to pass under it. All the ocean could do was to make the slick undulate like a lazy ripple of black silk. The prevailing current was already stretching the spill northward, even as the slick grew in size from the oil gushing off the rig in a black rain. When the drone approached the second platform under the terrorists' control, Cabrillo saw that this slick was even larger than the first. Although it was impossible, Juan felt like he could smell the sharp chemical stench of the crude as it poured into the sea. It scalded the back of his throat and made his eyes water. Then he realized that what he was sensing was his own revulsion to the willful act of environmental destruction and the mindless waste of human life. Singer's demonstration was the greatest act of ecoterrorism in history, and as much as he professed wanting to save the planet, his actions would see the Earth pay in a heavy coin. And if the corporation failed, the effects could spread half a world away. He gathered up his gear and headed for the hold. When he arrived, he saw that the room was crowded with more than 100 men, a few of them his own, the rest belonging to Moses and Debele. The Africans had already been issued weapons and ammunition, as well as clothing to make up for anything they lacked, sturdy boots mostly. They all sat on the floor and listened raptly as their leader addressed them from a dais made of pallets. His foot was swathed in surgical gauze and a pair of crutches rested against the bulkhead behind him. Juan didn't enter the hold, but rather leaned on the door jamb and listened. He couldn't understand the language, but it didn't matter. He could feel the passion in Ndebele's words and how they affected his followers. It was palpable. He spoke clearly, his eyes sweeping the room, giving each man a moment's attention before moving on. When they settled on Juan, he felt a tug in his chest as if Ndebele had touched his heart. Juan nodded, and Moses returned the gesture. When he finished his speech, the men gave him a thunderous applause that made the hold echo. A full 2 minutes passed before the cheering started to subside. "Captain Cabrillo," Moses called over the din. The men quieted instantly. "I told my people that to fight at your side is to fight at mine. That you and I are now brothers because of what you did for me. I told them you have the strength of a bull elephant, the cunning of a leopard, and the fierceness of a lion. I said that even though today we fight in a different land, this is the day we start to take back our country." "I couldn't have said it any better," Juan replied. He wondered if he should address the men, but he could see in their eyes, in the way they held themselves, that nothing he could say would inspire them more than Moses' words. He said simply, "I just want to thank you all for making my fight yours. You honor me, and you honor your homeland." He caught Eddie Seng's attention to get him to come over. "Do you have the duty roster figured out?"
"I have it here."
He tapped an electronic clipboard. "Mafana helped me sort through the men before their arrival, so I have a pretty good idea of their skills. I also have seat assignments for all the vessels involved in the assault."
"Any last refinements to the plan we came up with?"
"Nothing, Chairman."
"Okay, then.
Let's get this show on the road." Juan would be leading the assault on one of the oil platforms that had already been taken over, and Eddie would head up the other, so both men gathered up the handful of Zimbabweans coming with them and left the hold for the moon pool. Others would be using the ship's lifeboat and her fleet of other watercraft to hit the loading pier and the facility itself in a coordinated attack, with the Oregon, under Max's command, acting as fire support. On their way down, Max called from the op center.
"Just want you to know we'll be in position to launch the submersibles in another 10 minutes.
Juan checked his watch. Eric had gotten them here quicker than promised.
"Once we clear the doors, it'll take us another 20 to get to the rigs, so don't approach the coast until we call."
"I was paying attention at last night's briefing," Max said archly.
"Just before you launch your counterattack, we'll make a dash for the terminal and send out the lifeboat. We'll take out any of the terrorists hitting the other two rigs, then move into position off the dock. When we're close enough and can cover for them, Ski and Link will head out in the SEAL assault boat to cover the retaking of the loading pier."
Let's just hope that Linda's right and Macombo's men aren't willing to die to hold the terminal. Hopefully, if we hit them hard enough and fast enough, they will surrender quickly.
And if she's wrong and these guys really believe in their mission?
Then this is going to be a long, bloody day.
With the ship still underway, the hull doors under the moon pool remained closed, but the metal grating over the hole had been removed and the larger of the Oregon's two submersibles, the 65-foot Nomad 1000, was hanging above the opening on its lifting cradle. Capable of diving to more than 1,000 feet, the Nomad sported a cluster of lights around its blunt nose and a manipulator arm as flexible and delicate as a human's, but capable of ripping steel. The smaller Discovery 1000 was suspended above the Nomad and would be launched as soon as its big sister was away. Linda would accompany Juan while Jerry Pulaski was ready to mount up with Eddie. The shore attack would be commanded by Franklin, Lincoln, and Mike Trona, who were already getting their forces together in the lifeboat as well as in the amidships boat garage. Technicians had gone over the submersibles, so there was nothing for Juan to do but give the hull a slap for luck and mount the ladder a crewman held steady. The sub swayed slightly as he reached the top. He threw Eddie a quick salute and dropped through the hatch. Juan climbed down into the sub and made his way to the cockpit, a claustrophobic pair of reclined seats surrounded by dozens of computer screens, control panels, and a trio of small portholes. Though she was bigger than the Discovery, the interior of the Nomad was actually smaller because of her hull thickness, the massive batteries she carried to give her a 60-hour range, and the fact she was outfitted with a saturation dive chamber. Juan's crew had stripped out enough gear to increase her passenger load from 6 to 8, the same number as the Disco could carry. It would be a small force to attack the rigs, and only the cream of Ndebele's fighters would accompany the two subs. Linda crawled in after him, but didn't take her seat. She showed the men how to strap themselves in while Juan went through the pre-dive checklist. Cabrillo jacked a pair of lightweight headphones into the communications panel.
Nomad to Oregon. This is a comm test. How do you read?
5x5, Nomad, Holly answered immediately. We are nearly finished decelerating, Juan. Moon pool doors can be opened in about a minute.
Roger.
He looked over his shoulder as Linda crawled into her seat, setting her silenced machine pistol next to Juan's.
Everybody set back there?
A couple of the men didn't look too keen on being confined, especially when the hatch was dogged tight, but they all managed to mirror his thumbs up.
Mafana, you okay?
Though injured slightly during Moses' rescue, the former sergeant had insisted on accompanying Cabrillo.
I now have a better understanding of the Bible.
Juan's face showed his confusion, so Mafana added,
Jonah and the whale.
It'll be a short ride, and we won't be more than 50 or so feet underwater.
A series of strobe lights mounted throughout the 3-deck high room began to flash, and a horn would be sounding, although Juan couldn't hear it from inside the minisub. He looked down through the porthole as the large doors at the very keel of the ship began to open. Water sluiced across the metal as the sea was carefully allowed to enter the ship, quickly filling the moon pool to the Oregon's waterline. With a mechanical clank, the cradle supporting the submarine began to lower it into the sea. The water climbed over the portholes and the Nomad's interior grew noticeably darker, lit now only by the computer screens and a low voltage system in the cruise area. Once the sub was floating free, the cradle decoupled.
You're free, a crewman called over Juan's headset.
Affirmative.
Juan hit the ballast controls to flood the tanks, and in seconds the mini-sub submerged down through the moon pool and out into open ocean.
Nomads away. You can launch the Disco.
He powered up the motors, listening to the mechanical whine as the props bid in, and set the computer to level them out at 50 feet, deep enough that an observer on the surface wouldn't see the matte black hull cruising by. The Oregon's master computer had already calculated the course and downloaded it to the mini-sub, so there was nothing for Juan to do but enjoy the ride. 5 minutes later, Eddie announced they had successfully launched the Discovery, and they were en route to the second oil rig. Capable of only 10 knots, the ride toward the coast seemed to take forever, though Juan knew what was frustrating him was that every minute that elapsed meant more oil was being pumped into the sea. If he thought it would make a difference, he would have gotten out and pushed. "Oregon, this is the Disco," Eddie called over the acoustical link. "We've arrived at the rig and are hovering just below the surface. The oil slick must be 3 miles across by now."
"Disco, this is the Nomad," Juan said. "Computer puts us under our platform in 3 minutes."
He knew by how dark the ocean had become that his mini-sub was traveling under an identical oil slick and had been for some time. The Nomad's GPS system guided the sub between two of the oil rig's tall support legs and brought the craft to a halt mere feet from a third column, one they'd identified from the UAV overflight as having a ladder that went up to the top of the platform.
"Houston, the Nomad has landed."
"Roger that, Nomad," Holly replied. "Give us 1 minute so Tiny can double-check that you don't have company down there, and you're free to surface and pop the hatches."
Juan connected his headset back to his personal radio, levered himself out of the padded seat, and stepped carefully to the hatch, his MP5 slung over his shoulder. Mafana and his men undid their lap belts.
"Juan," Linda called down the length of the vessel.
"Holly says we're clear. There isn't anyone down here, but Tiny estimates there are at least 30 terrorists milling around the platform."
"Not for long," he muttered, then ordered Linda to gently blow the ballast tanks. Like a creature from a horror movie, the Nomad's broad back slowly emerged through the reeking mat of crude pooled under the oil platform. It oozed off the hull as more of the sub broached the surface, but was sticky enough to cling to anything protruding off the craft. Clots of oil stuck to the hatch combing and rudder.
"Masks," Juan said, and fitted a surgical mask over his nose and mouth.
Julia had researched the toxic crude and its effects on the human body, and as long as they kept their exposure down to a couple of hours and remained in well-ventilated areas, there was no need to wear more cumbersome gas masks. He hit the button to open the hatch and recoiled at the harsh chemical smell that assaulted his senses. Being this close to the slick made his eyes water. He climbed out of the mini-sub and clipped a line to the eye-hole welded to the hull. There was a barnacle-encrusted platform ringing the nearby support leg, and he leapt over to it, tying off the line to the integrated ladder. Set equidistant between the four towering legs, the riser pipe dropped down off the platform and into the ocean. Inside it would be the drill string for when the rig was exploring for oil, and pipes to allow oil to flow back up to be pumped to shore. Unlike some other fields, the crude was under enough pressure that it didn't need to be coaxed out of the earth. It gushed freely. And now that the terrorists had either destroyed pipeworks on the platform or opened some valves, it came tumbling back down in a waterfall of shimmering obsidian that twisted and scintillated in the clear morning sunlight. The sound of it striking the slick was like thunder. Juan tore his eyes away from the mesmerizing sight and glanced out to sea as the men started emerging from the Nomad. The Oregon was driving toward the coastline. Though she was an ugly industrial ship, more function than form, with a deck resembling a denuded forest of cranes and her hull a patchwork of mismatched paint, she had never looked better to him. Max was headed for the third platform, where Petromax employees were still holding off the terrorists, but were reporting that they were getting ready to abandon the rig in her lifeboats. The men defending the fourth platform were calling over the airwaves that they would never give up. After sealing the mini-sub's hatch, Linda was the last to jump from the Nomad to the platform. "Let's go," she shouted over the tumbling oil. "The air down here is going to play havoc with my skin. I can already feel oil clogging my pores." She then added with a saucy grin, "You can best believe the corporation is going to pay for whatever spa I go to."